occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. On today's show, another day, another report showing evidence that Israel is indeed committing genocide. This time, Human Rights Watch released a new report accusing the Israeli apartheid state of committing the crime of extermination and genocide against Palestinians. Despite the mounting evidence and even an arrest warrant issued against the Israeli Prime Minister himself last month, this year ends with more of the same, the usual Western hypocrisy. As usual, complete inaction, maybe some symbolic statements, and mostly full-on complicity, whether overt or subtle, by our own governments in the West. These countries that pretend or like to see themselves as the civilized, the developed, the countries of the rule of law and institutions, have proven yet again that in their eyes, crimes are only bad when the perpetrators are not us or our allies. We will start the show by learning more about this latest report by Human Rights Watch. We will then move on to the US and look at a lawsuit being brought against the US State Department for breaking US own law by continually ignoring the crimes committed by the Israeli occupation military. Then we will hear about the latest from the court cases in the ICJ and ICC regarding Palestine-Israel. And finally, we will see why, despite all the facts and evidence, some even brought in by UN departments, the UN is still incapable of doing anything to stop the genocide and ethnic cleansing that the Israeli apartheid state is committing against Palestinians, even after decades of supremacist colonial oppression against them. Stay tuned.
In a major new report, Human Rights Watch has accused Israel of committing acts of extermination and genocide by deliberately restricting safe water for drinking and sanitation to the Gaza Strip. Tirana Hassan, the executive director at Human Rights Watch, said, quote, "This isn't just negligence, it's a calculated policy of deprivation that's led to the deaths of thousands from dehydration and disease that's nothing short of the crime against humanity of extermination and an act of genocide," she said. The report details how Israel has cut off water and blocked fuel, food, and humanitarian aid from entering the Gaza Strip. In addition, Human Rights Watch accused Israel of deliberately destroying and damaging water and sanitation infrastructure, as well as water repair materials. Israel has rejected the Human Rights Watch findings, saying, quote, "The truth is the complete opposite of HRW's lies." But just in the past day, the United Nations said Israel had once again denied requests to deliver aid to Palestinians in Beit Hanun, Beit Lahia, and Jabalia, areas that have been under Israeli siege for months.
We go right now to Bill Van Esveld, acting Israel and Palestine Associate Director at Human Rights Watch. He helped edit the Human Rights Watch report just out today, titled "Extermination and Acts of Genocide, Israel Deliberately Depriving Palestinians in Gaza of Water." He's joining us from Athens, Greece. Bill, thanks so much for being with us. Why don't you lay out your findings?
Thank you very much for having me on this issue. I think this report lays out a clear state policy of depriving people in Gaza of water. So we looked at four different ways in which all access has been controlled and restricted. First, there are the water pipelines that come from Israel to Gaza. They supply only about 20% of the water in Gaza, but about 50% of the drinking water, because Gaza's aquifer underground has been completely contaminated over years and years of closure. So the first thing was cutting off those water pipes. The second thing was there are water resources inside Gaza, so those were cut off too. Those are desalination plants, those are water pumps going to the aquifer, those are water sanitation facilities, water treatment facilities. They all need energy. They need electricity, they need fuel. Israel cut off electricity and fuel within the first few days of the war, but that wasn't enough. Four of those six water treatment plants I was talking about in Gaza had solar panel fields that were their source of electricity in case electricity got cut off, because electricity has been terrible in Gaza for many years as a result of the siege. It wasn't enough for Israel to cut off the electricity coming from outside. They also sent in military bulldozers to systematically destroy every one of the solar panels in those solar fields, rendering those sanitation facilities completely offline. And two more issues. One is, you know, the infrastructure of water in Gaza has been so destroyed and damaged by the hostilities that it needs urgent repair. There was a major warehouse inside Gaza with a lot of spare parts. It was bombed, and the Palestinian staff who were there with their families, some of them were killed in that bombing. Finally, humanitarian agencies such as Oxfam, UNICEF, and others have been trying since the war started to get water and sanitation materials imported into Gaza to help purify water, chlorine tablets, all sorts of things to fix the network. Those were systematically blocked. Even at moments when the Israeli military was allowing other civilian items into Gaza, we were told those were blocked. That is a complete state policy of denial of access to water, and the results are horrifying.
So, Bill, just to convey, you begin the report by citing a World Health Organization figures about the amount of water, minimum amount of water that's required per person per day to sustain a life. What the WHO recommends is 247 liters per person per day. And since October 7th, 2023, people in Gaza, an individual in Gaza, has access to 2 to 9 liters per day, as against the 247 that the WHO recommends. So if you could say, Bill, on the basis of the people that you spoke to, that Human Rights Watch spoke to, what has the impact of this been on people in Gaza? What did medical personnel that you spoke to say? And also in terms of excess deaths, we hear, of course, of this horrific figure of 45,000 people who've been killed by direct attacks by the Israeli military. But how many more deaths are likely the result of water deprivation?
Thank you. Yeah, that's right. So in Israel, the average consumption per day is 247 liters per person per day of water. The minimum, absolute minimum required for life, even in an emergency situation, is 15 liters a day. And people in Gaza have been getting 2 to 9 liters a day on average. Now, that's an average that, in, you know, I should say in northern Gaza, for example, for 5 months, people got 0 liters of drinkable water per day. The effects are as horrifying as you might expect. We spoke to 115 or more people, people in Gaza, healthcare providers, and you know, the lack of water kills you in a million different ways. There are babies who have died directly from dehydration, but there's also people who are dying from disease and contracting terrible illness. I mean, you cannot bathe if you have no water, and 250,000 people at least in Gaza now have skin disease as a result. I mean, 1 5-minute shower is more water than people in Gaza get in an entire week. We spoke to surgeons who said that wounds are not healing because the bodies of the patients are so dehydrated. Kids were coming in dying in the hospital because they were drinking from contaminated water sources. Now, if you add to this the decimation of the healthcare sector in Gaza, that means that people are coming in with waterborne diseases that can no longer be treated. So children dying at large numbers of hepatitis A, which normally would have a death rate, but very, very small, that has ballooned horrifyingly in Gaza. If you add all of these things up, there is a huge hidden death toll. We know that 45,000 names have been collected by the Gaza Ministry of Health, but those are almost all people who were killed directly by explosive weapons or shot directly during the course of the hostilities. That doesn't include the hidden death toll of people dying from dehydration, starvation, disease, and illness. Now, there were 99 healthcare professionals who wrote a letter to President Biden and his administration in October, and they calculated on the basis of the International Committee that tracks famine and that has sort of global standards for the numbers of deaths expected, that based on the assessment of starvation and hunger and lack of water in Gaza, at least 62,000 more people may be dead in Gaza. That is, you know, we say thousands in the report. It could easily be tens of thousands or more. We are talking about a mass death situation that is the result of deliberate policy.
I want to go, Bill, to one of the many comments by Israeli officials quoted in your report to determine Israel's genocidal intent in Gaza. This is the former defense minister, Yoav Gallant, speaking just days after the October 7th, 2023 attacks.
I have ordered a complete siege on the Gaza Strip. There will be no electricity, no food, no fuel. Everything is closed. We are fighting human animals, and we will act accordingly.
Talk, Bill Van Esveld, about the significance of what he said here. Again, Yoav Gallant, at the time the defense minister of Israel, and actually recently, the ICAC has issued arrest warrants for him and Netanyahu, and even with those arrest warrants issued, the International Criminal Court, he just recently went to Washington, D.C. to meet with officials.
Yes, the same Yoav Gallant, an indicted war criminal by the International Criminal Court, was just meeting with the U.S. Defense Secretary and, you know, President Biden's senior Middle East advisor. It's really, really shocking. This is the same man who once said when the United States was going to sanction an Israeli military unit, we don't listen to the United States. No one will teach us about morality. Really disappointing move by the Biden administration there and others who met with him. What that statement of his and statements by other senior Israeli leaders in positions of control and command in the Israeli army and over this issue of denial of access to water. Their statements are evidence of an intent, and they were also carried out by the military and, you know, by the authorities. So it's not just they said something and it sounds bad. No, what they said was actually what they did. That's extremely serious, and that is part of what led us to the conclusion of extermination. That is a crime against humanity of deliberately causing mass death, and one of the ways that it's, you know, that can be committed is by depriving people of what they need to stay alive, such as water. That same crime, which we define and conclude is the crime of extermination, is the same act as one of the acts of genocide listed in the Genocide Convention and indeed in the International Criminal Court statute on its article on genocide, deliberately inflicting conditions of life on people calculated to bring about the destruction of that group. Now, what Gallant said there could be evidence of genocidal intent. Genocide is an extraordinarily difficult crime to prove because the intent must be, according to international law, that you are not just killing people in large numbers, which is extermination, but that you are killing them specifically because you want to destroy the group they are part of. And if you look at the evidence of Israeli military and government actions on water and statements like that one on water, we think you may have evidence already of genocidal intent.
So can I ask you, Bill Van Esveld, is this the first time the Human Rights Watch is accusing Israel of genocide in Gaza?
This is the first time that we've made a finding of genocidal acts in Gaza. It is not an accusation that we level lightly. We have not done this very often in our history. We accused the Myanmar military of genocidal acts against the Rohingya in 2017, and we found full-blown genocide against the Kurds in Saddam Hussein's Anfal campaign in Iraq in the 80s, in the 90s, and we found genocide against also in Rwanda in the 80s. An extremely difficult crime to prove. It is, you know, it, mass killing deliberately to destroy people because they're part of that group. Not something we level lightly, but yes, we found it here.
Bill Van Esveld, we thank you so much for being with us, acting Israel and Palestine Associate Director at Human Rights Watch. He helped edit the Human Rights Watch report just out today, titled Extermination and Acts of Genocide, Israel Deliberately Depriving Palestinians in Gaza of Water. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Five Palestinian families have sued the U.S. State Department for violating U.S. federal law by continuing to fund Israeli military units despite their role in gross human rights abuses in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. The lawsuit cites the Leahy Law, named after former Vermont Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy. The lawsuit says, quote, "The State Department's calculated failure to apply the Leahy Law is particularly shocking in the face of the unprecedented escalation since the Gaza War erupted on October 7, 2023," unquote. The lawsuit is supported by Dawn, the D.C.-based nonprofit that campaigns for democracy and human rights in the Arab world. This is a short clip from a video they produced about the lawsuit.
For almost 30 years, the Leahy Law has prohibited the United States from funding foreign security forces that violate human rights. Yet for decades, the United States has consistently ignored persistent and widespread abuses by the security forces of one country, Israel, and refused to block aid to any of its military units. Now Dawn is taking action. We are filing a lawsuit against the State Department to force it to finally enforce the Leahy Law and end military aid to abusive units of the Israeli Defense Forces. This lawsuit isn't just about ending the Israeli exception from enforcing U.S. laws, but preserving the broader principles of accountability, human rights, and the rule of law. We hope our lawsuit will force a long overdue reckoning for Israeli impunity, but also crack down on U.S. foreign policies arming abusive regimes around the globe, in violation of our nation's own laws and principles. This lawsuit also reflects the immense human cost of America's failure to enforce its own laws, continuing to provide Israel with over $20 billion in weapons to terrorize Palestinians in Gaza, where it has killed over 45,000 people, the vast majority women and children.
That video from the D.C.-based nonprofit Dawn that campaigns for democracy and human rights in the Arab world. We're joined now by Charles Blaha, a senior advisor to Dawn. He retired from the State Department last year after over 30 years of service. From 2016 until his retirement, he served as director of the Office of Security and Human Rights, which is responsible for implementing the Leahy Law worldwide. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. You work for the State Department, the agency that you are now suing, for over 30 years. Can you explain more fully the Leahy Law and what you're charging in this lawsuit?
Sure. And thanks for having me. The Leahy Law, as you said, prohibits United States assistance to security force units that have committed gross violations of human rights. It's actually very surgical. And it prohibits U.S. assistance to the specific units that have committed the violations. The State Department has for years in its own human rights reports, including the 2023 reports for Israel and for Gaza and the West Bank, set forth gross violations of human rights by Israeli security forces. Things like torture, extrajudicial killings, like the killing of Aisha Nur Ezgi Egi that you mentioned at the top. Deprived people of their liberty without due process. Rape under color of law. Enforced disappearances. These are allegations and credible reports set forth in the State Department's own human rights reports. And they go back years. Despite all that, the State Department has never once held any Israeli unit ineligible for assistance under the Leahy Law. The lawsuit, which is by the plaintiffs, is designed to try to compel the State Department to obey the law. So in three words, what this lawsuit is about is the State Department must obey the law.
Well, Charles Blaha, what has happened to these reports once the department, once they've been issued to the higher ups in the State Department?
Well, that's a good question, because usually the determinations about whether a unit is eligible or not are not made at the higher levels of the State Department. They're made by experts. They're made by action officers who are versed in the Leahy Law, who know the security forces in question, and who know the facts in question. And these are legal determinations. And one of the problems with the way the Leahy Law is applied, or really not applied, to Israel, is that these determinations have been made at the political level. And they have, as I said, resulted in not one single Israeli security force unit ever being found ineligible for assistance.
And how is U.S. military assistance delivered to Israel? In what form and where? And is this a standard practice, the way it's delivered?
Well, Israel is a special case. And we give massive security assistance to Israel. And part of that is a lump sum of over $3 billion annually that goes into an account. And where it goes after that is controlled by Israel. We don't know all the places it goes. We don't know the units it goes to. And that's a problem, because the Leahy Law requires vetting units. In that situation where we can't trace the units to which the assistance is going, the law requires the State Department to give the countries in question, and Israel's one of those, there are a few others, to give the countries in question a list of ineligible units. The State Department has never done that. That has been the law since 2019, and in five years, the State Department has never given Israel a list of ineligible units. It's given lists to the other countries that this law applies to, but not to Israel.
Charles Blaha, you often hear commentators on television, or I should say U.S. government officials, saying, don't be so concerned about this amount of money, $3 billion, because it's really going mainly to U.S. military, you know, to the weapons manufacturers. You hear that not only around Israel, but other countries that get U.S. military aid. Can you explain what actually happens? And is Israel a separate case where you don't know where the money goes, but in other cases, we insist that the money stays with U.S. weapons manufacturers?
Well, part of the money does go to U.S. weapons manufacturers. Part of it actually goes to their competitors in Israel. But the problem from the Leahy Law is, regardless of where that money goes, this is U.S. taxpayer money that's going to weapons that are being used in gross violations of human rights, being used by units that commit gross violations of human rights. That's the problem.
What differentiates this lawsuit from previous ones, against the U.S. government for providing military assistance to Israel, especially in view of the fact that Israel, with every war, Israel gobbles up more territory, creates more settlements, and becomes more and more of a rogue state?
Well, what makes this this particular lawsuit by the plaintiffs different are two things. One, it's being brought under the Administrative Procedures Act. And the contention under that act is that the special process that the State Department uses to Leahy vet Israeli units, it's called the Israeli Leahy Vetting Forum, that process is arbitrary and capricious and does not advance the intent of the Leahy Law. In fact, it seems designed to frustrate it. And the second thing about this lawsuit is that given the Supreme Court's recent ruling overruling the Chevron case, which says that courts have to give deference to agencies' interpretations of laws, that no longer exists. That's been overruled. And as our lawyer laid forth in the complaint, now the courts can look more closely at how an agency, at how a an agency or a department implements, or in the case of Israel, fails to implement the law.
Charles Blaha, former State Department official, served as director of the office responsible for implementing the Leahy Law.
And now, for the first time, hence the outcry by Western governments, specifically the U.S. and the Israelis, how dare the ICC turn its legal lens to the crimes committed by the Israelis and try to hold them to account when Israel is an ally to the West.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Deanna Butu. This year has seen an unprecedented number of legal cases before international courts, namely the International Court of Justice, which is also referred to as the World Court or the ICJ, and the International Criminal Court, which is also known as the ICC. In the ICJ, there have been three cases that deal with Israel's genocide, and another opinion dealing with Israel's 57-year military occupation. In the ICC, in November, the court finally issued arrest warrants against two Israelis, namely the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and the former, as Israel calls it, Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant. The arrest warrants relate to war crimes and crimes against humanity, particularly in relation to Israel's starvation of Palestinians in Gaza, its inhumane acts towards Palestinians, as well as murder. It took 6 months for the court to issue the arrest warrants, as the prosecutor announced back in May of this year that he was seeking these warrants. Even that announcement back in May was a long time overdue, as the genocide had continued for more than 7 months by that time. There's been a lot of skepticism regarding these international courts and cases because the process has taken so long, and of course because there's fear that it will lead to nothing and it will not stop Israel. So, in order to better understand these cases, I spoke to Dr. Nimr Sultani, who is a professor at SOAS in London. He's the editor-in-chief of the Palestine Yearbook of International Law. Nimr has published extensively on constitutional theory, on comparative constitutionalism, and on Israeli jurisprudence. Dr. Sultani is a frequent legal commentator for many media outlets. Nimr's tweets, which I highly recommend reading, by the way, can be found at Nimr Sultani. That's at NIMERSULTANY. Thank you, Nimr. Thank you for joining us today.
You know, Nimr, I wanted to begin by asking you your impression of all of these legal cases that are now going before the ICC and the ICJ, and specifically about the ICC. What did you think about the issuance of the arrest warrants November the 21st of 2024?
Thank you so much, Deanna, for having me. I'm delighted to have this conversation with you. Obviously, what we have been witnessing now is a watershed moment in our understanding of international law and also in the engagement of the Global South generally and Palestine in particular with international legal institutions. So this is a moment of test. This is a moment of examining the extent to which these institutions can deliver their promises. Obviously, the ICC in particular is important because now we have a formal vindication of Palestinian claims that top Israeli leaders are accused of being war criminals. And the fact that Israel will not deliver these accused to the International Court of Criminal Court will also solidify and consolidate Israel's image as a rogue state, as a pariah state, in which these are international fugitives who are accused of crimes, not only war crimes, but also crimes against humanity. Of course, the effect of these arrest warrants, as all the other international legal interventions by international institutions, will depend on the acquiescence or the enforcement by different states, in particular powerful and rich, rich ones, Western states. And the question is, as we saw in the case of the ICJ genocide case, as well as in the aftermath of the ICJ July advisory opinion on the legality of occupation, now we're also faced with the same question. Will powerful Western states, in particular the United States, be brazen in their defiance of the post-World War II international legal order? And that is a question not only for Palestinians or for Israel, but it's a question for the international legal order more generally. And are we going to allow these powerful states to destroy the legacy of post-World War II and the attempt to have some semblance of rule of law in international relations? Or are we going to go back to a situation in which might makes right?
We already know that the United States has come out, and rather than saying that they're going to, that they accept the ICC, they've quite gone the exact opposite way, saying that they're actually going to hold their own allies responsible for implementing the ICC, such as Canada, the Netherlands, and otherwise. As you put it, the Israelis are not going to turn themselves in. We also saw that there were some other countries that have said that they're not necessarily going to implement the ICC arrest warrants. Are there other avenues that are available for us to be able to widen the scope of these ICC arrest warrants?
Well, obviously, much hangs on future developments. So one question is, will the ICC prosecutor, as he indicated in May and then again after the pretrial chamber approved of the arrest warrants, will he have other arrest warrants against either other leaders and, you know, army generals in Israel, as well as other crimes that have been committed in addition to, you know, starvation and targeting of civilians? For example, the torture question comes to mind, given how much voluminous evidence is already there in the public sphere. There are also historic accusations and investigation that relates, for example, to the question of the settlements as a grave violation of the Geneva Conventions, as well as the Rome Statute. And then there's also the question of apartheid. These are issues that, unfortunately, the ICC prosecutor have kind of delayed or kind of had a foot-dragging policy, avoided bringing these allegations prior to October. So is the current ICC prosecutor's policy, or are these arrest warrants a beginning, or is it the end? Obviously, they have their own limitations in the way they were approached, but will they be complemented by more arrest warrants and more kind of accusations against the and charges against the Israeli leaders and soldiers? Because this the more this these arrest warrants and more these accusations become formalized in these legal venues, the more this will put to test the behavior of third parties, including states, but also, you know, corporations and universities, and as well as kind of international institutions and different parties within the UN itself. This should have ramifications on arms trade with Israel. We see more arms embargo now that the states are embarrassed by the fact that they have supported a state, whether politically or diplomatically or militarily, that have been committing these crimes. And will these states also, we need to remember there are three in addition to the ICC arrest warrants. We have also two other levels of obligations on the states. There are the obligations emanating from the prevention of genocide following the three orders on provisional measures by the ICJ. And then there are the sanctions, divestment, and boycott kind of resolution by the ICJ in July that was followed also by a UN General Assembly resolution that says that the occupation should end by 12 months. And obviously the ICJ also said that the settlements should be dismantled. So this leaves us with the different yardsticks to measure the behavior of all states, in particular Western states that have a capacity to influence Israeli policy through their close relations with Israel over decades. And we have now a situation in which many legal activists and strategic lawyering and human rights organizations domestically can also approach their own governments, whether they're through courts or other venues, as well as parliamentarians, in which they have to pressure these governments to comply with their own international legal obligations that have are very crystal clear now after all these interventions by the ICJ three times, the genocide case, the ICJ and the legality of occupation case, and now the ICC and the arrest warrants. What's important about the ICC arrest warrants in particular is that we had a skewed and kind of perverted practice of the ICC for over 20 years since its establishment, in which it has been basically perceived and used as a tool against the global south, or a tool in a kind of quasi-Cold War approach, that only the enemies of the West and those disliked by the West there was an attempt to hold them to account. And now for the first time, hence the outcry by Western governments, specifically the US and the Israelis, how dare the ICC turn its legal lens to the crimes committed by the Israelis and try to hold them to account when Israel is an ally to the West. What's fascinating about what we have seen in the last 2 or 3 years is that it coincided also by the Russian war and aggression on Ukraine. And it has been very clear how different were the reactions of powerful Western states and even, you know, mainstream media and mainstream academia as well, and mainstream, you know, corporations and civil society to Russian violations of international law, to Ukrainian resistance and supporting Ukrainians vis-a-vis these violations, and to supporting international criminal court, in particular to holding Putin or others to account when states like the U.S., who is not even a member of the ICC, has a historically hostile attitude to ICC, suddenly started supporting the ICC and then started dragging its feet in the last few months when the ICC prosecutor requested these arrest warrants.
One of the things that I found really interesting, or actually quite funny, was the Washington Post, which came out with their editorial saying that the ICC isn't the appropriate venue for being able to address this issue of war crimes. And I loved your response to it, which is they want to go back to the good old days when it's just a question of the ICC going after African leaders and nobody other than that. I want to pivot a little bit, Nimit, and ask you a question about how the ICC arrest warrants have been received inside Israel, in particular by other Israeli leaders and by the media and otherwise. What is it that you have seen and the response has been here?
The so-called opposition in Israel have stood firmly behind Netanyahu. On the one hand, because they understand that these ICC warrants are a blow to Israel's image in the world, to Israel's reputation and even Israel's legitimacy, and as well as it leads to opening the door to questioning their reaction, their military action, their genocidal reaction to the October 7 attacks. Because now this response, which they have supported wall to wall in Israel, you know, all the media, all the academia, as well as the political parties, except the few kind of Arab opposition parties, is now seen for what it is, a genocidal campaign, a campaign of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and the systematic targeting of civilians. One particular interesting response I saw a couple of days ago was a prominent Israeli journalist who writes for Haaretz. And he said in the beginning of his article, look, Netanyahu is the most despicable figure in the history of the Jewish people, quote unquote. And then 2 lines later, he says, but we are all Netanyahu, and this is an injustice to Netanyahu done by the ICC. And this is anti-Semitic, etc. So, you know, I don't understand this kind of disassociation between, on the one hand, this, you know, a very realistic understanding of Netanyahu as one of the lying and deceptive figures in politics, and then isolate this kind of personality and this kind of policy from his actual conduct, for example, in war, or separate between criticizing Netanyahu when he wants to undermine the judiciary and democratic institutions and or the press inside Israel, and then between wholesale support for everything he says and does with respect to international law or with respect to the attack on the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. And, you know, lining behind him when he makes absurd claims that he's the new Dreyfus and that the ICC is being anti-Semitic. But as you said before, what we have been seeing since, you know, in January, I called it an epic legal battle between the global south and the global north. And that is now intensifying with the ICC, because the ICC was one of these tools against the global south. And now suddenly it's doing a little bit of trying to hold a Western ally or a self-described Western and European oasis in the Middle East, a settler colonial movement like Zionism and its leaders, being held to account like everyone else as whether they comply with international law, whether these rules apply to everyone, or are they above these rules. And that creates a schism in which the obvious solidarity with the Palestinians, the obvious support with for Palestinian human rights, their freedom and equality for the majority of the population in the global south is now forcing many states to intervene in what we can call an anti-colonial attempt to create, you know, contradictions within the international legal system, to make the international legal system, which historically have been associated with colonialism and imperialism, face its own ideals, and whether it's going to bridge the gap between these ideals and its practice. And the ICC arrest warrants as well, again, reenact the same kind of tension, but in a much more kind of concrete way, because now it's not simply sitting on judgment whether Israel committed genocide or not. It's now a question, and it's not even delayed as, you know, 5 or 7 years when the ICJ makes that kind of legalistic determination. It's now about now. What do you do now? These are fugitives. Do you apply it or not? Or do you become as brazen as the Washington Post says and says, look, there are two rules here, one for us, one for them, one for whites, one for non-whites, one for the West, one for non and West. And then they have to explain what has been covert racism becomes overt racism.
Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. I'm Deanna Butu. Thanks for listening.
Governments in the global south, don't be in the shadow. Remember where you come from, the struggles of your people through their efforts and sacrifice and blood. This is a time to stand together for something better.
Israel has been bombing Gaza for over a year, but most of the world governments have either failed to stop the genocide, or in the case of the U.S., actively blocked the United Nations from taking action. The U.S. has vetoed a ceasefire resolution 4 times.
Maybe for some we have the wrong nationality, the wrong faith, the wrong skin color. But we are humans. Is there an international law for them, an international law for us? Do they have the right to kill, and the only right we have is to die?
Meanwhile, departments of the UN have been openly criticizing Israel's actions for months. Francesca Albanese is a special rapporteur assigned by the UN to investigate human rights abuses of Palestinians by Israel.
Israel is an apartheid state which has been predicated upon the erasure of the Palestinians, the dehumanization of the Palestinians.
Since the UN was created, it has been inextricably linked to the question of Palestine. It's also the place where countries can create and codify international law.
International law is not just a promise, it's a set of obligations. They are universal. They apply to the powerful and the weak, to the rich and the poor, to the large and the small.
But international law feels unequal when it comes to stopping Israel's assault on the Palestinian people. So what exactly was the UN's role in Palestine? How can the Global South community replicate previous successes to liberate the Palestinian people? And what does the future hold if countries no longer abide by international law? Francesca Albanese wrote two reports this year about Israel's genocide in Gaza. Her first report was titled Anatomy of a Genocide.
I concluded that Israel had committed at least three acts of genocide, acts of killing, infliction of severe bodily and mental harm, and creations of conditions of life that would lead to the destruction of the Palestinians in Gaza in whole or in part, supported by genocidal intent.
7 months later, she wrote a new report, Genocide as Colonial Erasure.
This is a state endeavor committed intentionally by state officials, military, political leadership, religious leadership. So all the state apparatus has been complicit in the crimes that have been committed against the Palestinians.
But Albanese also wants people to know that this isn't something new. It's been happening since the Nakba and Israel's creation in 1948.
Since its very inception, Palestinians have been forcibly displaced, dispossessed, increasingly segregated, and arrested and detained en masse. Their homes have been destroyed, their churches and mosques, their identity has become a liability. They've all become, through decades of Israeli unlawful occupation in what remains of Palestine, a security threat, a presumed guilty until proven innocent. So the history of the Palestinians at the hand of the State of Israel has been one of continuous ethnic cleansing. What happens today is what a settler colonial genocide looks like. This is the kind of destruction of a people in whole or in part that happens in a context where one people wants to dominate, take the land and the resources from another people and push them away, because their very existence as indigenous people is an identity and legal threat to the occupier, to the colonizer.
The United Nations was formed in 1945, primarily by the five major powers who won World War II: the Soviet Union, China, France, the United Kingdom, and the United States.
When the United Nations came into existence, it was constituted by 51 states. Most of the world was still colonized, meaning controlled land, resources, and people, primarily by European countries.
That included Palestine, which was under UK control. And tensions were high in the region after an influx of Jewish immigrants from Europe. 2 years after the UN was created, the UK tasked it with resolving what should happen to Palestine. The UN decided to partition the land. The UN plan would have given the Jewish settler minority, which only accounted for one-third of the population, the majority of the land. The much larger indigenous Arab-Palestinian population would get a much smaller portion. And Jerusalem was to be an international zone. The plan was rejected by the Palestinian people, but Israel used the plan to declare independence, and when war broke out, to forcibly displace nearly three-quarters of the indigenous Palestinian population in what's now known as the Nakba, or catastrophe.
Palestine is unique, but it's not unique. It's unique in the sense that it's standing tall and resisting the erasure that a colonial mindset has brought upon them. But this, again, this is what in history has happened to other colonized people.
While most other countries went through decolonization in the 20th century, Israel did the opposite. After the war in 1967, Israel colonized all the Palestinian land. To this day, it controls who can enter and leave the occupied territories and has been building more illegal settlements on Palestinian land every year.
And I know that this is painful to hear for Israelis and Israeli youth in particular who love Israel, and I don't blame them, but the point is that their country is imposing an apartheid regime on the Palestinians and is trying to erase the Palestinians from whatever remains of Palestine, which is what settler colonial powers in Australia, in Canada, in the United States have done with their indigenous people.
As decolonization expanded around the world, the UN expanded too. Now there are 193 member states, but only the five permanent members of the Security Council have veto power.
It has been quite a journey for most people in the world to liberate themselves from the yoke of this control, which is not completely undone there are still ties, economic, military ties, financial ties. The system has changed over time, and in my view, the major revolution came about with the decolonization, which gave impetus to a number of changes in the international system.
Albanese says the UN has been successful in the past at holding countries committing human rights abuses accountable.
Think of the Apartheid Committee that was set up to deal with the dismantlement of apartheid South Africa, with the identification of what apartheid was, and then little by little with dismantlement of the apartheid regime there. Israel is an apartheid state which has been predicated upon the erasure of the Palestinians. We need to act, we need to coalesce, we need to remember that we decide how much we support or we do not support this system by also adhering to what are the goals of the Palestinian movement, which is acting like it was against apartheid South Africa, to boycott, to divest and sanction the Israeli unlawful endeavor. And also, again, build coalition, build alliances.
And it seems there are coalitions building. Recently, Malaysia, partnering with other countries, proposed expelling Israel from the United Nations because of the genocide.
Israel no longer belongs within the civilized community of nations.
It is not the first time that we see countries from the global south taking upon themselves the struggle to bring about justice. It's natural because they are more aware than us in Western societies about the risks of permanent control and disempowerment.
Albanese says she can understand why many young people would feel like the UN and the international community is not doing enough.
Of course, the international justice system has dragged its feet. Of course, the International Criminal Court, the prosecutor should have acted before October 7, because it was already criminal enough, and the alleged perpetrators were already bragging about their crimes.
The International Criminal Court, which is independent from the UN, did finally issue arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant over war crimes in Gaza.
And now the UN face an unprecedented attack from Israel. The United Nations, whose premises and beneficiaries have been bombed, hit by Israeli weapons this year in Gaza, but also peacekeepers in Lebanon. And the Secretary General has been declared persona non grata, the General Assembly, the International Criminal Court, the Human Rights Council, everyone has been accused by Israel to be harboring terrorists or anti-Semites. This is unacceptable. This is why the test is how much the United Nations today manages to push back this hubris.
Albanese says she views now as a chance to help bring about change.
The time is ripe for a revolution to make the system better. It's important that especially young people understand the potential of this moment to make the world a better place, because on the time it takes to make the realization and act, it depends how many people will be able to save in Gaza and in Palestine.
The first thing she recommends people should do is hold their own governments accountable.
Justice starts at home by making sure that those policymakers who have enabled, in this specific case, the genocide to be invoked, to unfold, to continue, they have to be held accountable. Businesses from your own country who have profited from the unlawful occupation, the apartheid, and now the genocide. Every time we purchase from these businesses, we participate a little bit in the maintenance of the unlawful occupation and apartheid regime.
According to Albanese, what the UN does provide is a forum for people to have a discussion to prevent conflict. But the UN has been unable to do that because of pushback from Israel with US support.
The United Nations doesn't exist as a virtuous system other than us. It sums up who we are as member states, as family of nations, with its goods and bads, like with its setbacks and virtues. So we shouldn't romanticize or idealize what the United Nations is. However, this is a place where discussions on how to prevent conflict, how to ensure peace and stability for everyone, how to advance equality and freedom for everyone is to be held and then reflected into international policies.
Even though it hasn't been able to stop the genocide, Albanese says the previous successes of the UN shouldn't be overlooked.
It has allowed developing countries, global south countries, to liberate themselves and to make the system a little bit better. Let's build on this and make the system even better, because I'm really afraid of what we might be facing lacking. That is the return to a place of lawlessness where might make right, and we don't need to go there.
Albanese says her message to Western leaders hasn't changed since October 2023.
The slaughtering of children after children after children. I mean, how many other children need to die before our political leaders come to senses? Why not to be remembered for something good instead of destroying the planet? Do the right thing. Start by abiding by international law. Lead your country into a virtuous path.
That's it for this hour. On today's show, we focused on the latest report by Human Rights Watch accusing Israel of committing the crimes of extermination and genocide against Palestinians. Then we moved to the U.S. and looked at a new lawsuit being brought against the U.S. State Department for breaking U.S. own law by continually ignoring the crimes committed by the Israeli occupation military. After we heard about the latest from the court cases in the ICJ and ICC regarding Palestine-Israel, and finally we saw why, despite all the mounting evidence, the UN is still incapable of doing anything to stop the genocide and ethnic cleansing that the Israeli apartheid state is committing against Palestinians. If you missed parts of the show, you can go to CQUT's website at cqut.ca. and listen to it again. All the episodes are archived on our page. Just click on the name of the show and you will find them. You will also find the link to the archive on CFRC's website at cfrc.ca. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
CFRC's annual funding drive campaign is now underway through December 31st. Help us raise $25,000 to support our local arts and artists and keep our community informed with local news, concerts, and events listings on air and on our website. Visit CFRC.ca today and make your gift to Kingston's longest-running broadcaster serving our community since 1922. Get a tax receipt via Queen's University or get sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. For every $5 donated, you get one more chance to win. Thank you for your support.
And when I listen to a really good song, I start nodding my head like I'm saying yes to every beat.
Yes, 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 this rocks.
And then sometimes I switch it up like,
no! No! Don't stop a rockin'!
Every Friday morning, 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. You can't possibly find it funny anymore. It's been years. Let it go.